If you'd like to take your Bibles and turn to the second chapter of Colossians, we're going to begin there in just a moment. Before we begin our study tonight, I want to start by thanking the elders of the congregation here and thank the members as well for the opportunity to come here. It's been a number of years since I've had the opportunity and the privilege to preach here. A lot of new faces in the crowd every time I come here. I actually, although I don't know a lot of you now because there's been such a changeover of people in this congregation, I have a very long history with this congregation. I was, in 1986, I was assigned here to Fort Campbell, a brand new lieutenant in the Army. That was 40 pounds and a full head of hair ago. And got to know the people that were in the congregation here. Spent about 4.5 years here with the congregation, and then moved on. But have stayed in touch with them. Have preached here several times. Been back here on various duties and various times, and have stayed at my home away from home with Hester, my family and I both. So it's great to be back here and to see all of you again. I look forward to this. I always tell people on the first night of a meeting it will go like this. So get the best, the most that you can. You've brought me here, use me up. If you want to talk to me, you have my undivided attention. So let's take this concentrated effort, focus on God's Word. I asked the elders back in the spring when they asked me to come. I asked them, I said, is there a particular topic that you would like me to speak on? And all so often I get told, whatever you want to talk about. And really I don't like that because I'm always afraid I'm going to step in a hornet's nest when they tell me that. So the elders said, no, we do have something we want you to talk about. They selected the text of Colossians chapter 2 and they said, we'd like you to teach on the theme in six different lessons on the superiority of Christ over different things. And we get those different things, as they shared with me, we get those different things from Colossians chapter 2. And so if you'll turn to Colossians chapter 2, and I know that font's not going to be able to read it, so read it with the text. That's there for another reason I'll show you in just a moment. I do want to take the time, short chapter of only about 22, 23 verses, I want us to read Colossians chapter 2. And so we can understand exactly what Paul is dealing with. Paul in this text is dealing with the superiority of Christ because Christ is the head of the body. Like Ephesians talks about the body, Colossians talks about the head. It talks about Christ's deity. And so let's look in Colossians chapter 2, beginning in verse 1. Let's just quickly read the chapter so we understand this. For I want you to know what a great conflict I have for you and those in Laodicea and for as many as have not seen my face in the flesh, that their hearts may be encouraged, being knit together in love and attaining up to all riches of the full assurance of understanding to the knowledge of the mystery of God, both of the Father and of Christ, in whom are hidden all the treasures of wisdom and knowledge. Now this I say, lest anyone should deceive you with persuasive words. For though I am absent in the flesh, yet I am with you in spirit, rejoicing to see your good order and the steadfastness of your faith in Christ. As you therefore have received Christ Jesus the Lord, so walk in Him, rooted and built up in Him and established in the faith, as you have been taught, abounding in it with thanksgiving. Beware lest anyone cheat you through philosophy and empty deceit, according to the tradition of men, according to the basic principles of the world, and not according to Christ. For in Him dwells all the fullness of the Godhead bodily. And you are complete in Him, who is the head of all principality and power. In Him you were also circumcised, with the circumcision made without hands, by putting off the body of the sins of the flesh, by the circumcision of Christ, buried with Him in baptism, in which you also were raised with Him through faith in the working of God, who raised Him from the dead. And you being dead in your trespasses and the uncircumcision of your flesh, He has made alive together with Him, having forgiven you all the trespasses, having wiped out the handwriting of requirement that was against us, which was contrary to us, and He has taken it out of the way, having nailed it to the cross, having disarmed principalities and powers. He made a public spectacle of them, triumphing over them in it. So let no one judge you in food or in drink, or in regarding a festival or a new moon or Sabbaths, which are a shadow of things to come, but the substance is of Christ. Let no one cheat you of your reward, taking delight in false humility and worship of angels, intruding into those things which he has not seen, vainly puffed up in his fleshly mind, and not holding fast to the head, from whom all the body, nourished and knit together by joints and ligaments, grows with the increase that is from God. Therefore, if you died with Christ from the basic principles of the world, why, as though living in the world, do you subject yourself to regulations? Do not touch, do not taste, do not handle, which all concern things which perish with the using, according to the commandments and doctrines of men. These things indeed have an appearance of wisdom in self-imposed religion, false humility and neglect of the body, but are of no value against the indulgence of the flesh. Only the Apostle Paul could cover that much ground in 23 verses. He covers a lot. Matter of fact, we're going to spend the next six lessons, because I'm not as near as articulate as the Apostle Paul, in talking about and analyzing what he said in those 23 verses. He covers an enormous amount of ground, but what he is really dealing with, and I've highlighted it in that yellow, what he's really dealing with is there are about six topics there that he is trying to explain to the Christians at Colossae, that Christ is superior to the things that assault your senses. Christ is superior to those things. He has authority over them. And so, when we begin to look at it and think about it, we're going to break it down into these things. The idea of persuasive words, philosophy, deceit, principality and power, worship of angels, self-imposed religions. We would categorize it like this, and this is why we're going to organize this through this week. Tonight, we're going to deal with the idea of Christ's superiority over human reasoning. It's important that Christians get this. There's a lot of things, as you'll see as we go down, we're going to talk about the superiority of Christ over human philosophy tomorrow night, then human authority of mysticism, of human religion, and we're going to conclude with the superiority of Christ over the Old Testament law, the Noahic and the Mosaic covenant. But we're going to begin with the first one in regard to human reasoning. We are bombarded by human reasoning. And human reasoning says there is no God. Human reasoning says that's superstition, that's old-fashioned. Even within the realm of religion, human reasoning says, and we'll deal with this a little bit about on Sunday morning as we talk about Christ's superiority to human religions. Even human religions say you can do whatever you want to. I'm okay. You're okay. We can take different roadmaps and get to the same place. And so this Colossians chapter 2 is fundamental to what Christians face on a day-to-day basis. We've got to get it, and we've got to get it right. We have to understand it clearly. We have to, in our faith, be convinced, believe, and live and act in such a manner that we recognize the greatness and the superiority of Christ over anything a human can bring to bear. And so that's what we're going to think about tonight specifically. I borrowed a passage from Isaiah chapter 1 and verse 18, where Isaiah, talking for the Lord, as the Lord reaches out to the unfaithful people of Israel and says, "Come now and let us reason together." Let's talk about this. That one statement defies this idea that there is no reason or there is no logic in the way that God does things. That it's just a bunch of, as the world would say, it's just voodoo. It's just superstition. No, it's not. God is a logical God. He is a God of reason. And He asks His people, in effect, He is asking the people of Israel there, and I believe He asks us today, let's sit down and talk about this. You know, any parent understands this. There's a reason that God uses so often throughout the Bible the metaphor of a child-parent relationship to explain His relationship with us. It's because any child and any parent gets it. We recognize that. There's a reason He uses that metaphor. And every one of us who are parents have said to our children, "Wait a minute. We're not going to run off and do that. Come here, sit down, and let's talk about this." Now that may be, as we grow older, I'm mellowing out, as at least my kids tell me I'm starting to mellow out. I'm mellowing out as I get older. When I was much younger, it was not come here and let's talk about this. You know, I was chasing them through the yard with something, trying to catch them and force the, you know, force them to bend them to my will. But the Lord says, let's talk about this. So this week, we're going to talk about this. We're going to understand the superiority of Christ. We don't have to go to the world. We don't have to stand before the world with our head bowed down. This is particularly important for the young people of the audience. You don't have to go before the world with your head bowed down like you're not on the winning side. You are. You've got the best defense. You've got the greatest information. You're on the winning side. And we need to recognize that. And so tonight we're going to reason together. We're going to talk about the superiority of Christ to human reasoning. I wrestled with the text that I was going to use, but I finally come to the conclusion that I believe that the best text to demonstrate this, one against the other, human reasoning against divine reasoning, was chapter 5 of Matthew in the Sermon on the Mount. So if you want to now flip over to Matthew chapter 5, we'll spend the balance of our time together tonight thinking about Matthew chapter 5 and the Sermon on the Mount. In this text, and again, I think this is one of the finest examples. It's not certainly not the only one, but I think it's one of the best examples of a place where we can see the contrast between what happens when human reasoning is left to its own, this time about a spiritual application. It's about human reasoning in regard to the law of Moses. What happens when human reasoning is left to its own devices, and what happens when divine reasoning intervenes. Chapter 5, I think, is probably one of the best contrasts of this. And so that's what we're going to think about tonight as we think about the superiority. I'm a simple guy. You won't have to spend much time with me to figure this out. I'm a simple guy. This is not 3 points. Somebody told me a long time ago, you know, every sermon's got to be 3 points and then you're done. I'm not that simple. And I'm not that articulate. I've got several, but I do want us to recognize there's format to this. There's function to it. When we look at Matthew chapter 5, we see an outline of Matthew chapter 5. We refer to them as the Beatitudes, then the Similitudes. We're going to begin in verse 17 with the idea of Christ, because this is important. This is important to kind of fundamentally to what we're going to say about His sermon, is that we need to recognize that Jesus is not condemning the law of Moses. And in fact, He says to His audience, I'm here to fulfill it. Not the opposite, I'm here to fulfill it. That will become important to our study in just a moment. And then, to demonstrate that, He makes a contrast between the accuracy of the law of Moses. Now I want you to kind of remember this as we go through this. Through the proper interpretation of the law of Moses and how the Pharisees had interpreted the same. And we'll discuss that in greater detail as we go along. And so, there are a few key passages. Number one is in Matthew chapter 4 and verses 23 and 24. Before the actual Sermon on the Mount begins in chapter 5, it says, Jesus went about all Galilee, teaching in their synagogues, preaching the gospel of the kingdom. That's important. I think that's an important point because what we don't want to come to the conclusion of in the Sermon on the Mount is that Jesus is simply tending to a Jewish infight. That's not what that's about. Part of what it's about, it's not all of what it's about. So we need to recognize whatever He says in the Sermon on the Mount, He's preaching the gospel of the kingdom. In other words, it applies to us, ultimately. I mean, I got it. In the immediate context, we weren't there, we didn't get it, we weren't the receiving audience, but it applies to us. Why? He's preaching the gospel of the kingdom. Is it in looking forward? Yep, kingdom not established yet, got it. But it's looking forward, it still applies to us. Secondly, He goes on in chapter 5 and verse 17 where He says to the audience, do not think that I came to destroy the law of the prophets. I didn't come to destroy, but to fulfill. So again, is He going to address the Jewish inaccuracies in interpreting their own law? Yes, He is. I hope I can explain it well enough and that you are as impressed about the masterful nature of His teaching at the conclusion of chapter 5 as I was you know, when I study. Because it is. This is masterful teaching. Jesus is explaining to those Jewish listeners, look, what I'm getting ready to say, I'm not defying the law of Moses. As a matter of fact, I'm fulfilling it. I come to make it complete, make it whole. And then he makes a statement that I think sets the remainder of chapter 5 into context. These illustrations that we're going to talk about in just a moment. He sets those in context in verse 20 when he explains to them, I say to you that unless your righteousness exceeds the righteousness of the scribes and Pharisees, you will by no means enter the kingdom of heaven. So what do you mean? What's he talking about? First, he's talking to those who would become his disciples as Christians. Secondly, he's talking to Jews who, whether they decide they're going to become disciples or not, he's going to talk to them about their disrespect and their application of human reasoning over divine reasoning in interpreting the law of Moses. And third, he is reminding his disciples that if you can't do better than they did, if your righteousness is going to be as shallow as he's getting ready to demonstrate, if your righteousness is going to be that shallow, if it doesn't exceed the righteousness of the Pharisees and the scribes, your hope of entering the kingdom of heaven is nil. He's trying to convince those who would be his disciples, you need to look at this from a different perspective than these legalists. You need to get beyond that. You need to look at it from a perspective of change from the inside out. And he's going to demonstrate that. You need to be respectful of the reasoning of God. You need to be respectful of divine authority. But now he's going to illustrate that in 6 illustrations. This is the actual structure of this portion of the sermon. He's going to use 6 illustrations to demonstrate how a disciple of Jesus can exceed the righteousness of these scribes and Pharisees that he's dealing with. He's going to talk about murder and hate, lust and adultery. Connected with lust and adultery is the sacred nature and the binding nature of the marriage relationship. He's going to talk about taking oaths. He's going to talk about going the second mile and loving your enemy. Let me say, we'll conclude with this at the conclusion of the lesson, but I want you to think about it as we go through the lesson. I had a friend that makes the point of this part of the lesson that this is talking about radical discipleship. And I would agree with him. This is inside out change. Because Jesus really is beginning to, he's pushing them toward the conclusion that you can't just act the right way. You have to believe, you have to think, and from that belief and that thought will extend your actions. It's not good enough just to do the right thing. You have to do the right thing for the right reason. It is the idea of submission. It is the idea of giving in completely to God and submission before Him. So let's go through these very quickly. I want you to notice the key phrase. To me, this is just what I do. To me in my studies, if I see a phrase more than once, I'm not telling you that God has to say something more than once for us to listen. I had an algebra teacher when I was a freshman in high school, and I am not a mathematician. And apparently it's genetic, because none of my kids can seem to get through math either. But I am not a mathematician. I had a wonderful algebra teacher, and bless her, she did her best. But even as a freshman in high school, I wanted to be a soldier. I didn't see what algebra had to do with jumping out of airplanes, so I didn't. So what? But come study time, she moved me to the front, made me sit in the front first. And come study time for tests, she would stand next to her desk and we would be reviewing and she would go and point at me. That was Tony's cue that that's probably going to be on the test. My friends, in the course of one chapter, if the Creator of the universe says something six times, it's going to be on the test. When God intentionally repeats Himself in key phrases, you better pay attention. You better listen carefully. He's trying to get something across to us. It is that moment one of my children used to, if she wanted to get my attention, she would grab both my cheeks. Because I was all the time doing something else. If she wanted Daddy to pay attention, she'd grab me by both sides of my head and look me right in the eye and tell me what she had to tell me. Why? That got my attention. God's trying to get your attention. This key phrase, you have heard it said, but I say to you, is Jesus' way of saying to them, the Pharisees have interpreted it this way, you have heard it said, I say to you, it should really have been interpreted like this. And so notice that as we go through each one of these. Chapter 5, verses 21 and 26, he deals with the topic of murder and hate. You have heard that it was said of those of old, you shall not murder, and whoever murders will be in danger of judgment. Now look, and now he's going to say, but I say to you. So let's understand, he's not throwing those two verses in competition with one another. They complement one another. He's not taking these two phrases and putting them in competition with one another. That's a direct quote of Exodus chapter 20 and verse 13. There is no way that the Lord is saying, well, that's out. That really doesn't count. You don't have to really listen to that. He's not saying that. We don't understand fully what he's trying to say until he gets down to the next part. But I say to you that whoever is angry with his brother without a cause shall be in danger of the judgment. So let's notice what Jesus is trying to explain to him. What does he mean? What he means is, the Pharisees and the scribes have all along told you, don't murder. Jesus says, I'm telling you, I want you to concern yourself with where murder begins. And it begins in the heart. A few years ago, you know, they started talking about hate crimes. I always thought that was kind of sadly laughable. Because Jesus says every murder is a hate crime. Jesus says every murder comes from the heart and begins with hate. That's why we you know, unless you're just some kind of raving psychopath, you just don't wake up one morning and decide you're going to kill somebody. No, what does it start? It starts with an argument. It starts with a disagreement. Over time, what happens? Hate is generated. And so Jesus says, look, I want you to keep this one, but he said, what I'm telling you, the Pharisees have told you not to murder. What they didn't tell you, what they didn't wrestle with, is where murder begins, and that's the condition of someone's heart, dealing with humility and forgiveness and submission and servant leadership. That's where they didn't deal with it. So, and look, let's be honest about this. We even use this in our language today. I didn't kill anybody. Right? That seems to be the great... You know, if you didn't do that, apparently everything else is all right. You know? I didn't kill anybody. I didn't commit murder. That's what Jesus is trying to get across to them. That's the attitude to His audience. That's the attitude that y'all are taking. Now you think as long as I didn't commit murder, it doesn't make any difference if I hate this guy or if I hate this person. Jesus is saying, I'm telling you, you not only don't you murder... You don't even have hard feelings toward them. As a matter of fact, if you're going to have hard feelings toward them, therefore, that's the next key phrase. If a Bible speaker or writer uses the word therefore, pay attention. They're getting ready to make a conclusion. Therefore, if you bring your gift to the altar and there remember that your brother has something against you, leave your gift there before the altar and go your way. First be reconciled to your brother and then come offer your gift. Jesus says, look, this is so important that if you come to worship God, don't appear before God until you work this out with somebody. I have long I have unfortunately been involved in many congregational divisions. And I'm going to tell you what conclusion I come to. Sometimes we lie each other about wanting to be in heaven with each other because we can't stand, apparently, to be in one another's presence here on earth. If there is one lesson that I could, you know, that I had the ability to slap into people, it would be this one. Brethren, we are sinning before God when we hold hard feelings and hatred and meanness against a brother or a sister in Christ. It will cost us our soul over petty disagreements that almost never have to deal with doctrine and spiritual application. Jesus is saying to His people, don't even come before Me in that condition. Work it out and come back and worship God freely. Because He recognizes the Pharisee's solution is you can hate as much as you want as long as you don't act on it. Jesus says that's wrong. You can't have those feelings. You can't harbor those feelings. Just a few years ago I had somebody come to me and said, do you think I have to forgive this person? I said, no, you don't have to forgive them as long as you're comfortable with spending an eternity in hell. Is that really what you want to do? You don't have to. It's your choice. But we've got to get beyond this. Jesus says, you work it out. Somebody told me not too long ago, you don't understand how hard it is. I don't care if I understand. It doesn't make any difference if I understand how hard it is. He said, do it. Apparently we're capable. And so that's the first illustration that He used. Now He goes to lust and adultery. Matthew chapter 5, beginning in verse 27. Here's that key phrase again. You have heard that it was said of those of old, you shall not commit adultery. Another direct quote from the law of Moses, Exodus chapter 20 and verse 17. Now again, Jesus is certainly not going to turn around and say, hey, really, that's okay. We know He's not going to do that. What does He do? But I say to you that whoever looks at a woman to lust for her has already committed adultery with her in his heart. In his heart. That's the point. That's the fundamental foundation of this part of the text. In his heart. You don't want to commit adultery? You know what? Don't lust. Don't put yourself in that position. Because if you don't lust, you're not going to commit adultery. And so Jesus is saying, yeah, look, they were right to say that don't commit adultery. I'm telling you, you should go to the next step and not even lust for someone. Because if you do, you know what ultimately is going to happen? Everybody in the room knows what ultimately is going to happen. If you decide you want something bad enough, for some reason human nature seems that we'll figure out a way to justify it. And so Jesus is telling His disciples, look, let's step back from this. All right, let's not look at the sin of adultery. Let's look where adultery starts. You know, again, as parents, we everyone understand this, don't we? We everyone understand this. We get it. We start with our children and say, whoa, wait a minute. Don't worry about teen pregnancy. Let's step back one more step before that. We're going to talk about something else. I was told, I've got two daughters that have married and left home, and they never wanted to bring their boyfriends around. I don't get this. But they never wanted to bring their boyfriends around. But finally, you know, one finally came around, and I told them as they left on their first date, I said, son, I said, remember as you leave this door, whatever, if you decide to touch her, that body part belongs to me. Don't think you're going to take advantage of my daughter when you leave here. I wasn't worried about teen pregnancy. I wanted to back up one step beyond that. I wanted to come back one more step and say, you know what? We're not going to get in a situation where your heart is going to be left unguarded, and the situation is going to be left unguarded, and that sin is committed. And that's what Jesus is asking them to do. Take a step back. Let's consider what starts this before we try to prevent it. Notice what he says in his conclusion of this. This is what is sometimes referred to as radical surgery. I'll tell you, I don't think Jesus is being literal. I will say that much. Because the reality is, we everyone understand, if somebody really wants to lust, because it is a function of the heart, you could pluck both eyes out and not be able to see, and still lust after the object of your desire. And Jesus understands that too. Here's his point. His point is, in order to save your soul, you better be prepared to perform some radical surgery. What are you prepared to do? What are you prepared to do? A brother approached me one time. Adultery. His wife had committed adultery. It was within a congregation. He said, "What do you think I ought to do?" I said, "I'll tell you what I do." I said, before my wife and this man would see each other three times a week, I'd find another congregation in another community, in another town. I'd root my life up to put my marriage back together. Radical surgery. What are you willing to do? Jesus said, if your right eye causes you to sin, pluck it out and cast it from you, for it is more profitable for you that one of your members perish than for your whole body to be cast into hell. And if your right hand causes you to sin, cut it off and cast it from you, for it is profitable for you that no one of your members perish than for you to be your whole body to be cast into hell. You know, a few years ago, that guy out in Zion, in Zion National Park, did you hear about this story where the fellow was rock climbing? Broke every rule of every outdoorsman. Went by himself to a wilderness area, fell, got his arm cut. That was on a Saturday. On Wednesday, he had to cut his own arm off. You know what? That dude wanted to live. That guy understood this. He understood it. The arm's dead. The rock can have the arm. I want the rest of the body. I'm not willing to stay here and die. Jesus is asking his audience, what are you willing to do? What are you willing to do for the kingdom of heaven? You willing to enter it with just one eye? With just one hand? It's better to enter it in both lame and blind than it is to be cast whole into eternal damnation. He connects, notice he says in this one, he says furthermore. He connects these two illustrations. He recognizes that lust and adultery are completely counter to the sacredness of marriage. They're connected. So he connects these two illustrations with furthermore, it has been said, whoever divorces his wife, let him give her a certificate of divorce. That is a direct quote of Deuteronomy chapter 24 and verse 1. It was there. However, let me say this about Deuteronomy chapter 24. Jesus makes the point in Matthew chapter 19, from the very beginning it was not so. But because of the hardness of your heart, Moses allowed. In other words, Moses made a concession because you were so hard of heart, you weren't going to keep the wife of your youth. And so Jesus takes them back again, one more step. Shouldn't have been a certificate of divorcement because marriage is intended to be for life. Period. From the very beginning, it was not so. One man, one woman, one life. Till death do we part. Jesus says, so look, to his Jewish audience, look, Pharisees have always told you this. You're going to put away your wife, at least give her a certificate of divorcement. Jesus says, wait a minute, let's take a step back. He's not denying that. He's not denying that it's not in the law. He recognizes that it's in the law. What he's saying is, we can solve this problem. We don't have to worry about certificates of divorce. He says, I say to you that whoever divorces his wife for any reason except sexual immorality causes her to commit adultery, and whoever marries a woman who is divorced commits adultery. Jesus is taking it back a step. He said, look, let's be clear about this. This is an issue of the heart. Quit worrying about this certificate of divorce. God made a concession because of the hardness of your heart. I'm telling you that the way you should have interpreted that was, You should have stayed with your wife with the exception of adultery. And gender is unimportant here. He's not just saying that for the men. The gender, you take the gender here and flip them over, it doesn't make any difference. That's not the point. And so he says, look, marriage is sacred, it's binding. A piece of paper doesn't make it go away. He next goes in verse 33 and 37 to the idea of what you say. You have heard that it was said to those of old, you shall not swear falsely, but you shall perform your oaths to the Lord. Let me say something very quickly, because sometimes we think we know what this is saying when sometimes we don't quite get it. Very quickly, if you would, turn over to Matthew chapter 23. I'll demonstrate this as quickly here as I can, because I think this is an important point. In Matthew chapter 23, Jesus again is dealing with the Pharisees here toward the end of his ministry. And notice verse 16. Woe to you blind guides who say, whoever swears by the temple, it is nothing, but whoever swears by the gold of the temple, he is obliged to perform it. Fools and blind, for which is greater, the gold or the temple that sanctifies the gold? And whoever swears by the altar, it is nothing, but whoever swears by the gift that is on it, he is obliged to perform it. Fools and blind. And he goes on and gives a couple of illustrations. Here's what had happened during this time period, during the New Testament time period, is that the Jews had developed this habit, a bad habit, of swearing oaths, not like we would in a court of law, not like we would as a commissioned officer, a police officer, or an officer of the court, not like that. But they would swear oaths to lend credibility to the truthfulness of what they were saying. In the absence of our parents, some of us may have done this when we were little kids, when we would say, I swear on a stack of Bibles. Remember that? That was supposed to lend credibility. No kidding. I'm telling you the truth because I said it. You know, I swore on a stack of Bibles, so it can't be a lie. That's what they were doing. So they would say, I swear by the temple. Or I swear by the gift that is on the temple. They extended this hypocrisy by saying, well look, if you swore by the temple, you really are not obliged to keep it, but if you swear by the gift that is on the altar, you are. I mean, if it wasn't so sad, it would be laughable. That's what Jesus is referring to here. You have heard these words said. So he explains what the interpretation of that is. Again, direct quote from the Levitical law. But I say to you, do not swear at all, neither by heaven, for it is God's throne. So here we have that, you know, swear on a stack of Bibles moment. That this is not just saying, I promise I'll keep my word. This is not just saying, hey look, I'll bear truth and allegiance to the same. That's my oath. But I say to you, swear not at all, neither by heaven or earth, and so on. And so he says, let your yes be yes and your no be no. He kind of concludes it. Don't worry about these oaths. Let your word be your bond. He's not denying what Leviticus 19 says. He's clarifying what Leviticus 19 means. He goes on to the next illustration. Go the second mile. You have heard it was said, an eye for an eye and a tooth for a tooth. Now I'm going to tell you something. For a long time we have misinterpreted this. I say we. I'm painting with a broad brush. I get it. So bear with me. We need to be careful because I'm going to tell you something that means what you think it means. From Exodus 21, what that means is when he used that illustration, we use it improperly. When God uses that, an eye for an eye and a tooth for a tooth in Exodus 21 in the Levitical law there, what he is conveying to them is let the punishment fit the crime. He's not talking about personal vengeance. That's how we apply it. You know, my mama and my grandmother, all of them, you know, so I was a little kid, so I got picked on a lot. And I kind of had a Napoleon complex, so I would fight back. And I'm a little bit combative anyway, and so there was a lot of confrontations. And my mama and my grandmother, bless them, they did their best. Son, you know, you can't, an eye for an eye and a tooth for a tooth, we don't do that anymore. Man, if I had known this information back then.
You know, let the punishment fit the crime, Mom.
So we apply it as personal vengeance. Well, let me tell you something. Let me tell you why he chose to use that. So did they. So did they. That's the way they were applying it. An eye for an eye and a tooth for a tooth. Jesus goes on to talk a little bit about this and continues, I tell you not to resist an evil person. Whoever slaps you on your right cheek, turn the other to him also. If anyone wants to sue you and take away your tunic, let him have your cloak also. And whoever compels you to go 1 mile, go with him too. Jesus is saying, defer to them. Don't get involved in personal vendettas. Don't get involved in personal vengeance. That's the way they applied this. Now, if you used it accurately, it still stands. Let the punishment fit the crime. That's the way God intended it to be used. These Pharisees were interpreting, and that's the reason he says, you have heard that it was said. They are interpreting it as, if he did something mean to you, you are completely within your rights to go back and do something to him. Jesus says, forget about it. Defer to it. And I'm going to tell you, we're not going to talk about it tonight. A lot has been made of turn the other cheek, turn the other one to him also. I don't think this is dealing with self-defense or assault. I believe that it is dealing with indignity. I don't think he's talking about somebody coming after you with a gun, a baseball bat, or their truck. I think what he's talking about is somebody treating you harshly. The idea is kind of a backhand. You're insignificant. Jesus is dealing with, when somebody treats you with indignity, don't respond in kind. I'm not talking about defending yourself. And so, he deals with that, trying to explain that with him to go in the second mile. Love your enemies. This is his last one. You have heard that it was said, you shall love your neighbor. And if we can end right there, they'd be accurate, because that's a direct quote of Leviticus chapter 19. But hate your enemy is not in there. It was a New Testament Pharisaic misapplication of Deuteronomy chapter 23 verses 3 through 6 about keep the enemies outside the camp. It was a security issue. In a spiritual way, it was a cleanness issue in some ways. But it didn't have any... They were not allowed to hate people. I mean, when you get to the conclusion of this sixth illustration that Jesus gets to, you've got a pretty bad image of the New Testament Jew. You know, their leadership is telling them, you can hate. You know, you can get involved in personal retribution. You can lust. You can do all that. But he didn't commit murder. Jesus says, no, I say to you, love your enemies. Bless those who curse you. Do good to those who hate you and pray for those who spitefully use you and persecute you. This is a hard issue. Jesus is saying, take one step back. You don't have to worry about hating your enemy if your heart is in the right place. His conclusion, that you may be sons of your Father in heaven. For he who makes the sun rise on the evil and on the good, and sends rain on the just and on the unjust. For if you love those who love you, what reward have you? Do not even tax collectors do the same. And I'm going to tell you something, brethren. I want us to pause as brothers and sisters in Christ and think on that. Here in this last illustration where Jesus is talking about loving your neighbors and hating your enemies, I want us to pause and think on that. That concept that Jesus says, look, if you love those who love you, what reward have you? You know what? It's easy to love someone who loves you back. Isn't it? That's what I love about a dog. I've got, you know, I'm not a big animal guy. I've had a lot of animals in my life, but, you know, I have tended to keep a level head at it. But when the one I've got now goes, I'll have to admit, I will probably shed a tear this time. Because he is just the best dog. I love dogs. Because it doesn't seem to make any difference what I do. He's happy to see me. I can forget to feed him. Tomorrow morning I'll come out. He's just as happy to see me as the night before when I fed him. Jesus said, what credit. Even the publicans, even the tax collectors love people who love them back.
I'm telling you, it's a little bit more difficult to love somebody who really doesn't like you deep down inside. That's a gut check. That is spiritually more difficult. That requires some change on your part. After all, hey, look, I don't have to do anything to get, you know, if somebody already loves me, I don't have to do much. You know, my grandparents, bless their heart, they spoiled me. My grandparents, it was just like my mother would harp at my grandparents and say, you are killing me with this kid. He comes back and I have to beat him for 2 weeks to get him back in shape. You just let him, I could do no wrong in my grandparents' eyes. It was so easy for us to love each other. I just thought they were great. I want to move there, Mom. It's tough here. I want to move with Grandma and Grandpa. They let me do whatever I want. Easy for us to love each other. Harder when I got home and Dad said, Grandpa ain't here to protect you no more, son. It's time to crack the whip. It's time. The discipline's back. The regimentation is back. You got to obey. You got to do it. Vacation's over. Harder for now us to love each other. I didn't want to do that. Jesus is saying tax collectors do that. And if you greet your brethren only, what do you do more than others? Do not even tax collectors do also? Therefore, you shall be perfect, just as your Father in heaven is perfect. And I want you to kind of remember that last clause, because we're going to talk about that in detail on Sunday. We're going to talk about the idea of being more like God. Being more closely connected to the divine nature. So that is his last illustration. So let's put this all together. There are a couple possibilities that we can draw from in the course of these six illustrations. Is Jesus negating the law of Moses, thereby superseding the law and setting in place the law of his gospel? Because after all, remember, we started in chapter 4 and verse 23 through 26 talking about he's teaching the gospel of the kingdom. So is he saying, when he says, you have heard it said of old, I am saying to you now, is he really saying this is what the Old Testament said, this is what the New Testament's going to be, and therefore the Old Testament is out? That's one possibility. Here's the second possibility. Is Jesus correcting the manner in which the Jews, in particular the Pharisees, had interpreted, understood, and applied the law of Moses? In other words, is he predominantly talking to the Jews, primarily the Pharisees and the scribes, and saying to them, you have heard that it's said of old, your interpretation, but I say to you, the proper interpretation, is he doing that? Or, and I think this is the answer, is he doing both? That's the reason I said, that was my aha moment. That's the reason I talked about why Jesus is such a masterful teacher. Because he just did both with the same sermon. In a lot shorter period of time than I have. In just a matter of a few verses. You get down to this aha moment. The actuality is he's doing both of these, not just a single one. He is saying to the Jewish audience, to the Pharisees, you guys have gotten it wrong. You've concentrated on the action instead of the springboard for action, the heart. If you'd concentrated on the heart, you wouldn't have had to worry about what happened. If you'd have fixed the inside, you wouldn't have had to worry about the outside. To his disciples, though, he is saying, however, this is the way that I want it under the gospel as well. When you come to my kingdom, this is the way that I want you to live your life. Not as a legalist, but from the inside out. Have a pure heart. So when he begins to contrast these things, that's what he's doing. Remember this last point right here from verse 20. Unless your righteousness exceeds the righteousness of the scribes and Pharisees. I wanted to bring you back to that point. Because that's how he starts these illustrations. Before he launches in talking about murder and adultery and marriage and oaths and loving your neighbor. Before he launches into all that, he is reminding his disciples, you're going to have to do better than they did. They didn't get it right. You're going to have to do better than they did. These six illustrations illustrate, I believe,
probably better than any other text that I could find. I thought of a couple others that I thought about talking about tonight, but better than any other that I could find, that illustrates the difference between human reasoning and divine reasoning. Isn't that better? Here was the Pharisee way of doing business. Don't murder. Don't commit adultery. Give them a certificate of divorce. Perform whatever oaths you make. Love your neighbor, hate your enemy, eye for an eye. Look at what Jesus says. Don't hate. Don't lust. Don't divorce. Don't swear. Go the second mile. Love everyone. See what he did there? See how he frames that? This is not about legalism and actions and what I can get away with and what I can't do. What the thous and the thou shalt nots are. And let me say this. Our conclusion should not be that the law of Moses was a law that was not of the heart, that was a law that was not from the inside out. It was. Jesus illustrates, fellas, this is the way it should have been all along, and you missed it. All along, it should have been from the inside out. All along, it should have been a matter of the heart. All along, you should have been converted in your heart. And we see time after time after time the rebellion of Israel. And it's because they weren't converted in their heart. And my friends, you can sit in as many Church of Christ buildings as you want to. You can come to as many services as you want to. You can be here every time the door is open. You can live a morally pure life. And at the conclusion of this life, if your heart was not changed based on your faith in Jesus Christ, it was for naught. This is a matter of the heart. It's not good enough to try to change people's actions. I've told a lot of folks, you know, I've got a lot of experience at it. I've been in the military for almost 18 years. Active duty and reserve. I've got 3 combat tours. If I want to, I can change your attitude. If I wanted to, I could change your behavior before you could get out the door. I told a congregation one time, I said, you want the building full? I'll fill it. Get me a U-Haul van and a double-barreled shotgun. But folks, what do we got at the end of the day? We've got a building full of scared people is what we got. That's it. If I put the heat on you to change your behavior, what do we got at the end of the day? We just got scared people who want to get away from me. We just got scared people who just want this psychopath away from here. Just get him out of here. We don't have changed hearts. That's our challenge, is to first change ours and then be able to explain to people why we changed our heart, what changed our heart, and that is the superiority of Christ over human reasoning. Human reasoning doesn't cut it. Human reasoning says, I didn't commit murder. Human reasoning says, I didn't commit adultery. Oh yeah, you know, I was involved in all kinds of online pornography. I looked at every woman that I had an opportunity, hoped that, you know, I could get rid of my wife and find one of them. But I never committed adultery. I never divorced her. And when I did, I gave her a certificate of divorce. You know, I always said, that's human reasoning. You see the flaw? You see the problem? It doesn't lead us any closer to God. This divine reasoning, this leads us closer to God. I don't think there's probably a better contrast in all of the Bible. That's pretty radical. And I'm going to tell you, the people who heard it didn't like it either. I'm telling you, they didn't like it. Because that's radical. That's a radical theology. That shook those people up. For thousands of years, they had been following these traditions. That Jewish audience didn't like what they heard. But there were some in that audience who got it. They understood it. They were empowered by it because it made sense. Because it was an internal change. You know, every one of us, again, we go back to that parent idea. Every one of us who are parents get this. When we see that moment, when a rebellious child begins to get it, they begin to change. They're getting mom and dad's message. They're starting to understand. The school of hard knocks is starting to take effect. They're beginning to get it. They're beginning to understand. You can see, I always promise myself I'll never say to my children what my dad did to me. And you know what? Anymore, every time I open my mouth, I can hear his voice. You know what's interesting? Now my children are growing up. You know whose voice is coming out of their mouth? Mom and dad. God feels that about us as we change our hearts, as we start to get it, as we start to understand it, as through our faith in His Son, we start to get it and we start to change it. We begin to take effect. And it begins to be an internal change instead of just this external, to keep the elders off my back, to keep people from calling me, to keep people away from me. I'll put on this facade. That's not Christianity. That's not salvation. That's not repentance. That's not discipleship. What's the condition of your heart tonight? You're the only one that knows. You and God are the only ones that have that knowledge. But I would tell you, regardless of the condition of your heart tonight, here's what opportunity you do have. You have an opportunity to start over. I think that's the most refreshing thing about our relationship with God, is that I have the ability to say to God, I'll lay it all at your feet. The slate will be wiped clean. I'll start over. I'll do better. I won't quit. I'll submit to your way of doing things because your reasoning, Lord, is better than I can offer. If you're here tonight and you're subject to the invitation, I'd ask that you not put it off any longer. Make your heart right with God tonight. Because we don't know how much longer we each one have. If you're here and subject, ask that you come while we stand together, while we sing.